This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In North Carolina and across the country, new data shows that the coronavirus is hitting black communities hardest. Rates of contracting and dying from COVID-19 are disproportionately high. And some, including U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams, think lifestyle choices and personal circumstances play an important role.
We do not think people of color are biologically or genetically predisposed to get COVID-19, but they are socially predisposed and to have a higher incidence of the very diseases that put you at risk for severe complications of coronavirus. You are not helpless, and it's even more important that in communities of color, we adhere to the task force guidelines to slow the spread. We need you to do this, if not for yourself, then for your abuela. Do it for your granddaddy. Do it for your big mama. Do it for your pop-pop. We need you to understand, especially in communities of color, we need you to step up and help stop the spread so that we can protect those who are most vulnerable.
But many public health experts say the reasons are more complicated than that. Lori Carter Edwards is with us. She is associate professor at the UNC Gilling School of Global Public Health. Lori, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us, William Sandy Darity, director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University, co-author of the new book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. Sandy, welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
Lori, let's talk about this personal responsibility for a moment. There's been some discussion about whether or not behavior and choices factor into higher instances of coronavirus cases in black communities. What is there validity to that?
It's much more complicated than that. We are often looking at what is now a common term that's been used for years, is the social determinants of health. And because they're complex and interrelated, it is difficult to just say that there's one factor that contributes to this. And so social determinants of health are the conditions in the places where we live, learn, work, play, pray, and age. So income, jobs, food deserts, literacy, safe housing or lack thereof, or even geographical location. For instance, in our state, we're a rural state, how well we are able to get to resources and not just have social disruption, but even social isolation in our rural communities where many blacks may live. Even healthcare access all contribute to the cascading effect for why blacks may have a greater propensity for the mortality and the morbidity related to COVID.
So I want to look at each of those elements that you talked about and those factors in greater detail. But Sandy, first, what is your take on the Surgeon General's comment?
I think the Surgeon General's comment is one of the standard comments that suggests that the kinds of disparities that we're observing in the midst of this crisis are due to cultural and behavioral differences between blacks and non-blacks in the United States. This is a very conventional kind of argument. It is not correct. It's not valid. And I think it needs to be challenged and reconsidered.
Well, Lori Carter Edwards at the Gilling School, let's talk about some of those social determinants then, if there are these underlying factors. Break them down for us. Give us a sense of what it is that would be different based on race and based on historic, let's say, racial discrimination that might play out in a pandemic like this.
Well, certainly, even as your show started, jobs where many blacks are in positions of employment that make them in these critical roles where they're having to actually be out in the public, be exposed more than other race-specific groups. And so they're exposed. The transportation that they may not have their own transportation, they would have to take public transportation. In fact, what we saw in Michigan, a bus driver died just from people not being exposed to people on the bus that then spreads the disease. Some of it is related to people not knowing, but sometimes they are not aware of it because they haven't received the information. The housing issue, one of the good things that's going on, particularly like in Mecklenburg County, to stop what is a systems issue of evicting people who may have lost their jobs, is that the sheriffs have advocated the legal system to halt evictions in the presence of COVID. And that is a positive systems approach to address this issue. And I've already mentioned about the geographical location issues of even just safe environments or physical environments. And now that people are in place, it makes it sometimes very difficult if people have not been out or they're exposed with this contact with someone who may be sick, and then you're spreading the disease. Whether that is more so for Blacks than other race-specific populations is a question. But here's one that I'll end with this piece. When we talk about geographic locations and how this can spread, we think about these systems issues, such as what Kamara Jones mentioned, this being not just a medical emergency approach that has to be taken, but this is a public health crisis. And possibly the Surgeon General was responding from a medical or an individualized approach. But this is a public health crisis that is impacted by all of these pieces. And when you have these structural insults, like the Diamond Princess cruise ship being docked in Oakland Bay, not in San Francisco, though that's where it stopped, what happens to that community that is predominantly Black, and you're now docking people who have the virus and the potential for it to spread in a predominantly Black community, something that they are not in control of? So these are just a few of the examples of some of the social determinants of health.
Well, Sandy, get us more now. Let's talk a little bit more about the structural part of that. We've got the social determinants. So if people find themselves in a position where they have to take public transportation, they're more at risk. Where perhaps they're not able to work from home, they're more at risk. That may just be a coincidence. What's the structural part in all of this?
I think the structural part has to do with occupational crowding. That is the disproportionate presence of Black workers in positions that I describe as kind of the missionary jobs in American society. This is essential work that's often low paid, and it requires a significant amount of personal contact. It's personal service work. So Blacks, for example, are 25% to 30% of home health services workers, nursing care facilities workers, residential care facilities workers. With respect to the bus driver example that Lori just mentioned, Blacks are 32% of bus service and urban transit workers, and 30% of taxi and limousine service drivers. And so these are jobs in which the exposure to the virus is likely to be higher, but they are also jobs that we are going to need people to continue to perform in a very dangerous setting. And so that's a structural factor. It's the occupational distribution that's one thing. A second structural factor is associated with what we call pre-existing conditions. And in the health disparities context, there's a substantial amount of evidence that Blacks come into the crisis situation with a higher disease incidence of things like asthma, diabetes, heart disease, and related illnesses. But there's a more fundamental pre-existing condition, which is the degree of wealth inequality in the United States that underlies all of these disparities that we're considering. I would highlight this by saying that Blacks constitute approximately 13% of the nation's population, but collectively have less than 3% of the nation's wealth. And if you were to work that out on an average per household, it means that Blacks typically have $800,000 less in net worth per household than whites in the United States.
And of course, this leads to much of the precarity. If you don't have anything to back you up in a moment like this, that adds to the stress and the worry about what is even going to happen when this is all over. Lori, these factors are correlated, are they not? Wealth and the kind of stress associated with not having the resilience to rebound correlates to public health as well in those pre-existing conditions that Sandy was talking about. Am I right?
Absolutely. Definitely these chronic diseases or these pre-existing conditions exacerbate the burden. And it may vary by, let's say, even the literacy levels that are part of the structure as well. So when we think about education as one of the factors or access, some of that access is due to the ability to have resources to be aware of what's going on. In communities that are burdened, you may have general literacy or illiteracy, health illiteracy, technological illiteracy, and economic illiteracy, which Sandy was just mentioning. So if you have these four levels of literacy that are lacking, not because of the individual, but because of the environment in which they're in, they're already starting at a disadvantage. It's like systems are very difficult to describe, and we see you'll see in the literature about health equity, which is defined as everyone having equal opportunity to optimal health. If you don't start off with equal opportunity, you're already starting at a disadvantage. So when Sandy was talking about the Black wealth or even having pre-existing conditions, Blacks have already started behind the eight ball when COVID hit. So now the system accelerates the burden of disease because of not being at that same level as other populations.
Lori, let's talk a little bit about some of the ways in which we were initially testing and treating this pandemic. Initially, the CDC was only reporting confirmed COVID-19 cases by age and location. Race demographics were late emerging. Do you think that could have made a difference if that had been surveyed initially in terms of where we are today?
It would have made some difference. It's only one piece of the puzzle when we think about addressing all the parts of preventing more cases and more deaths. But I was glad when someone from the Office of Minority Health and Health Disparities had spoken up and asked for this to be included. This is an issue across the country where this capture of race has not been consistent. And if we do it, I think that we would find more of the hot spots sooner. So we could prevent some cases and possibly some deaths if we were testing and knowing where the testing was occurring and where to provide resources. But we are also finding that resources, even when we find out where places where they're needed, they're still not getting there.
Well, let's talk about Mecklenburg County for a minute, because of the nearly 1,000 cases of coronavirus there, about half of them African-Americans. Do you know why that is?
Again, this is a testing issue. In fact, some of the pastoral leaders, the faith leaders that are in Mecklenburg County, have been pushing hard with the county commissioners to make sure that there are testing sites in Black communities to try to improve that. So they're fighting really hard to get that taken care of. What you'll find, which is interesting and also it's disturbing as well, is that in the state, despite Blacks representing 21% of the population, they represent 37% of the deaths. But even when we think about testing or the number of testing and then the cases, the number of cases for whites is 2,800, but the number of cases for Blacks is 2,000. So they're almost equal when we have a much larger white population here in Mecklenburg County. Hopefully, I think the issue is clearly testing, and hopefully we can improve that with people on the ground doing exactly what they're doing, advocating for community partners.
Well, let's talk more about what can be done, Sandy. When the coronavirus outbreak began, many businesses were struggling to make conditions safe for people who did not have an option of working remotely. How can we change that structurally? Some of these jobs employ health regulations. Can they be improved in the future? What do you see happening?
Yeah, but I want to first push back a little bit on the use of the language economic illiteracy, because I much prefer talking about economic deprivation. I don't think that there's an issue concerning Blacks' knowledge about finances that's at stake here. What is at stake here is a long history of denial of wealth accumulation. And so I want to say that at the outset. But there's a number of things that can be done to try to address the question of people's capacity to work and to work safely. One of the first things we can do is increase the capacity of people to work remotely. And a way to do that is to provide universal Wi-Fi access on a national basis. That's something that the federal government should do. A second thing that could be done is for the Department of Labor's OSHA division to set up protocols and regulations for people to work safely. The former Assistant Secretary of Labor for Employment, Bernard Anderson, has said that the federal government should finance the provision of a variety of safety measures that would include the provision of pre-entry temperature checks, employer-provided masks and gloves, social distance standards in cafeterias, widely available hand sanitizers, and frequent wipe downs of surfaces in businesses. And this would make it possible for people to go back to work on a much safer footing. And then the last thing that I want to emphasize at this moment is we would be in a very different world if we had a national health insurance program.
Yeah, and think of, well, national health insurance, I mean, talk just a little bit more about that, because so many workers, especially at the low end of the economic, the low wage spectrum, have very little in the way of health insurance provided through their employers. And then we don't have national health insurance. And then, of course, in this state, Medicaid wasn't expanded, leaving 500,000 North Carolinians without coverage.
Yeah, so there's a tremendous precarity that you talked about before. If individuals work in jobs where they don't have a sufficient number of hours to be eligible for benefits, they won't have health insurance. If they lose their jobs, employer-provided health insurance is denied. And we're talking about a situation now where maybe the national unemployment rate will climb as high as 30%, which means that the black unemployment rate might be closer to 50% because it's conventionally two times as high as the white rate. So there's a tremendous danger that we're facing in terms of the safety of most of our population in terms of health access. And so a national health insurance program would be the obvious antidote for those conditions.
And of course, this balance between safety and economic security is something that people who are maybe at the low end of the wage spectrum are facing every day. Patrick McNeil is a grocery store employee in Durham. And here's what he had to say about what he feels he needs to do to be better protected in his job that he feels he must show up and do.
I work for a large grocery chain. I'm going on strike because I feel like us as workers should get PTO because we're working in an environment where we can get infected. And as a maintenance dude, going behind everybody, cleaning up, I can easily catch that. And I feel like that's wrong in every way.
Patrick McNeil, a grocery store worker in Durham. Patrick's story comes to us through NC Raise Up and Fight for 15, a group of advocates for fast food and low-wage workers to receive a fair wage and a right to form a union. Lori, we talked about access. You talked earlier about access to health, and I wonder what measures we should see to level the playing field for health care and treatment access.
Well, there are a number of ways that we can do this, and Sandy has. Thank you, Sandy, for correcting me on the deprivation piece. But the National Health Insurance Plan, I think, definitely making sure people are able to afford care is going to be critical. At the community level, I think that where communities, organizations, foundations that are now galvanizing and providing resources to close some of the gap. It's temporary, but at least it's something. From a structural standpoint, I think Sandy hit it, is that we really have to have this universal access to care. I think that in terms of reaching particular populations, we will have to do a better job of even creating new workforces to address some of the issues. Community health workers play a critical role, and they're on the ground as well, but they are also trusted individuals in communities where they can not only provide education and information, but they can also help be a liaison between resources. And so this is just one other small measure that's on the ground to try to improve access to information and to care.
You know, we think about universal health care, and we're looking now at the cost of responding to this pandemic, and this will not be the last one. So we're looking at the cost of being behind the curve and responding to this. And Sandy, one of the ways, of course, you could have gotten ahead of it was by lowering those pre-existing conditions through better health care, which might have been done by national health through national health insurance with more people covered. But you also talk about a federal job guarantee idea. And again, we're spending a couple of $1 trillion now paying people because they're out of work. Tell us about your idea about a federal job guarantee.
Well, I think one of the amazing things about the $2.2 trillion package is it reveals that the federal government can, in fact, pay for virtually anything it wants to pay for, that it's a matter of will and it's not a matter of financial capability. So I've been an advocate of a federal job guarantee, which is an assurance of employment for all adult Americans through the public sector, with a provision that these public sector jobs would provide a wage that is above the poverty level and would provide a benefits package that would be comparable to that held by all current federal civil servants. If we had already had a federal job guarantee in place, it would have been possible for us to keep all Americans on a payroll in the event of job loss. We would already have the infrastructure for that kind of payroll provision in place. In addition, we would have the capacity to more effectively shift people into lines of employment where they would be safe. From a health standpoint, we would be able to provide employment opportunities for artists and entertainers who no longer can tour or benefit from large public gatherings. This was something that was done in the 1930s with respect to the Works Progress Administration. Historians, scholars, and artists were actually hired to continue doing the type of work that they normally do. And we could rejuvenate our postal system with an additional set of workers from the public sector. So the world would have been different had we already had this in place, but it is not too late to adopt it. In fact, I think that the current crisis makes it even more urgent that we adopt a federal job guarantee.
Well, certainly this demonstrates that we can pay for it, we can afford it, and if we don't do something, we're going to have to pay for it again through emergency funds. But my question to you, Sandy, is what are these jobs in the meantime? When there's not a crisis, doesn't the market tell us what jobs we need and what jobs we don't? And if they're not out there, if those jobs are not created, market saying we don't need them, what are these federal jobs that you're going to create?
Well, actually, I would not rely upon the marketplace to provide us with all the socially necessary work that we have at hand. So, for example, I mean, the way in which the system is operating now is we do not have an infrastructure for solarization of the economy. And we certainly could pursue having a green economy with a labor force from a national job guarantee program. We also could professionalize the provision of care work. We could make that something that is a nationally provided service, and it could be provided at an expense level that's much less than people are confronted with now, particularly with respect to elder care, which is extraordinarily expensive. So if we were to make the transition out of the present moment, there still would be a significant amount of valuable work that could be done through the public service.
Well, Lori, let me ask you about that, a kind of a broader question that I think Sandy suggests in the last part of his answer, which is that the market hasn't fully professionalized all of the health care that we can deliver, particularly in elder care. How do you feel about that sector? And should we be approaching the way we provide health care in a different way? Right now, we've left it to the market. This is the system we have. How would you imagine that system changing? And could a more intentional kind of employment program improve the health care system we have now?
I think so. And we're talking about just specifically when you talk about elder care, right now, there are very few workers that are trained at another level to try to provide the care that's necessary at these nursing homes. But it should be a new transition to a workforce that not only provides this basic care, but education for the population that is for intergenerational care. So one of the things in an elder care situation is that we have children, families, and many of them are left in isolation. And that's one of the big issues in terms of isolation. How can we build a workforce that takes into account the aging process and the family process in ensuring that the holistic approach to, let's say, in the case of elders, that they're cared for, that the person that's the caregiver is cared for, and those that are coming along. And we've seen some work in this particular area, but it's limited. And I just wanted to focus on that particular one as an example of where we could be building a structure that is larger than just working within the nursing home, but the whole system of working with the families and create workforce components within each one of those stages.
Well, Sandy, let's look ahead a little bit. If poverty or financial instability are the real underlying conditions here, then the impact on Black communities is not going to lessen when the coronavirus pandemic is contained. What are some of the areas that we can expect to see long-term struggles in the recovery?
I think that one of the long-term struggles that we can see in the recovery is the question of whether or not there will continue to be aggravated mortality among Black Americans. Will there continue to be excess mortality among Black Americans, independent of the conditions that are created by the coronavirus? We already did have excess mortality in the Black community as a consequence of prior deprivation of adequate health, and that's something that's likely to continue unless we make some major policy changes now.
Well, we spoke with a woman from Graham, North Carolina, about her concerns for her family's financial future. Here's what Joanne Hinman had to say.
Economically, we're going to hurt. I mean, someone's got to pay back that stimulus money that got sent to us. It was our money, and it's our money that's going to have to refill it again. I think we're going to get hit in all directions. I think the cost of living is going to go up because of all that's going on. It's depressing to think about.
Joanne Hinman, a listener from Graham. Sandy, last year, a resurgence in interest in the idea of federal reparations program for Black Americans. This pandemic may have tabled the discussion, but I wonder how you feel about it and whether we should revisit it now.
So Kirsten Mullen and I, who my co-author on From Here to Equality, we just did an op-ed for the Philadelphia Inquirer that appeared Monday morning, in which we argued that the case for reparations is actually reinforced by the current pandemic, that it's reinforced by the current pandemic because of the relationship between the kinds of health inequalities that we are observing and the wealth inequalities that are so substantial and pervasive. And the way in which we could eliminate the racial wealth gap that I talked about earlier, $800,000 per household, the way in which we could eliminate it is through a reparations program. And that's an appropriate policy to keep on the table, fully on the table in the present moment. I mean, my view is that this is a situation in which we could treat a horrible crisis as an opportunity to truly transform our economy and our social relationships in such a way that if we're confronted with a new crisis of this type, we will be much better positioned to try to cope with it.
William Sandy Darity, director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University, and co-author of the new book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. Lori Carter Edwards is associate professor at the UNC Gillings School of Public Health. Thank both of you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.